progress in ceasefire negotiations.
Israeli Foreign Minister Gideon Saar on Monday said negotiations toward a possible release of hostages in exchange for a ceasefire in Gaza had progressed.
One of the great American cities is still on fire.
I've never seen, you know, a force of nature like this, the winds and the dryness.
And an update from the front lines in Sudan.
In the streets of Wad Madani, civilians and soldiers celebrated what could be a turning point in Sudan's devastating civil war. The strategically important city, capital of Al Jazeera State, was recaptured from the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces by the Sudanese army over the weekend.
Today is Tuesday, January 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Potentially a big day for the Middle East as significant progress is being made on the ongoing ceasefire negotiations between Israel and Hamas. Mediators gave Israel and Hamas a final draft of a deal on Monday to end the war in Gaza. This after a midnight breakthrough in talks attended by envoys of both President Joe Biden and President-elect Donald Trump. Reuters' Zachary Goldman has our story.
We also discussed a possible hostage deal.
Israeli Foreign Minister Gideon Saar on Monday said negotiations toward a possible release of hostages in exchange for a ceasefire in Gaza had progressed. That comes as an official briefed on the negotiations described to Reuters a midnight breakthrough in talks between the sides in Doha. The official said the text for a ceasefire and release of hostages was presented by Qatar. The session included envoys of both outgoing U.S. President Joe Biden and U.S. President-elect Donald Trump. Others present included representatives of Israel's Shin Bet and Mossad intelligence agencies. Officials on both sides stopped short of saying a final draft had been reached, but confirmed progress at the talks.
Israel wants a hostage deal. Israel is working with our American friends in order to achieve a hostage deal. And soon we will know whether the other side wants the same thing.
A Hamas official who asked not to be named told Reuters on Monday that discussions over some core issues for a ceasefire deal in Gaza had advanced. The United States, Qatar, and Egypt have worked for more than a year on talks to end the war in Gaza, so far fruitlessly. Trump's January 20th inauguration is now widely seen in the region as a de facto deadline. The president-elect has said there would be, quote, hell to pay unless hostages held by Hamas are freed before he takes office, while Biden has also pushed hard for a deal before he leaves. The warring sides have agreed for months broadly on the principle of halting the fighting in return for the release of hostages held by Hamas and Palestinian detainees held by Israel. But Hamas has always insisted a deal must lead to a permanent end to the war and Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, while Israel has said it will not end the war until Hamas is dismantled. Israeli Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, a hardline nationalist who has opposed previous attempts to reach a deal, denounced the latest proposals as a, quote, surrender and a, quote, catastrophe. Angry family members of Israeli hostages confronted him at a Knesset session on Monday, accusing him of abandoning their loved ones.
That's Zachary Goldman of Reuters reporting for us. And joining me on the phone to go over the potential deal is Joe Truesman. He's a senior research analyst at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies.
What we know right now, at least according to reports from, you know, from Jerusalem, is that this hostage deal or ceasefire deal will come in two phases. There's a first phase where a certain amount of hostages will be released. And then the second phase will come into effect where the rest of the hostages are released. Nevertheless, but this deal is much more broader and may lead to a permanent cessation of hostilities. I think this is the key point here. However, I think there's a very important message here, or rather an important note that people should know, is that if there is a ceasefire and if there is a permanent cessation of hostilities, at this moment, Hamas and its allied groups, armed groups in the Gaza Strip, still remain intact, all right, at least intact enough to regenerate. So that means that Hamas will continue to rule the Gaza Strip and will be able to regenerate, rearm, recover.
So was that a concession that Israel made in order to get the deal passed? What pushed it over the edge? What got this deal done?
Right. It may be a concession. Now, we don't know all the details, but this is what I suspect. Now, what pushed it over the edge? I think there are a number of factors here. Obviously, with the new administration coming in the next few days, I think President Trump had some influence over it on both sides. So that's one. Of course, international pressure on Israel, I think, was a factor. And of course, the status of the hostages. I think there's a tremendous amount of pressure on the Israeli government as well from the families of the hostages. So it is influencing things. Now, we also have to understand, too, that this is not just an Israeli issue or there's a pressure on the Israelis. There's pressure on Hamas. It understands that, it can only last so long in this war, despite going on for 16 months. And its supporters, namely the Axis, the Iranian-backed Axis, has weakened considerably throughout this war. I think that's a problem for Hamas, and it needs to understand first and foremost, or it knows first and foremost that its number one priority is to survive the war. All right, that is a priority. So I think right now it sees this moment as a opportunity to take that to take a ceasefire. And the way I see it right now is survive the war, right? To stay in power in Gaza.
Now, Joe, we've heard stories like this before. As you mentioned, the war has been going on for 16 months. There was a deal before to release some hostages in exchange for some Palestinian prisoners. We've had news reports like this where they say there is great progress and a deal is imminent, only to have it fall apart. Is it different this time?
I don't think it is different. Unfortunately, we're hearing this positive news, but we've heard positive news before, right? Not only once, not twice, but several times. So I think this is why I think many people are characterizing this, and I'm the same way, characterizing this as cautious optimism. Remember, Israel is negotiating with terrorist organizations, and it's just not Hamas. There are Palestinian Islamic Jihad as captives, and there's other organizations as well that are a part of this, armed organizations in the Gaza Strip. And of course, there are nation states that support Hamas that have an interest here. So there's a lot of factors. There's a lot of players. So things can change quickly, all right, despite positive news. So again, cautious optimism, but I think when I see hostages being transferred on TV from Hamas to Israel, then I'll know for sure that this is legitimate. But for now, I wouldn't put too much into this until more news arrives about the progress of the ceasefire.
Joe Truesman is a senior research analyst with the Foundation for Defensive Democracies. Mr. Truesman, thanks for your analysis today.
Thank you.
President Joe Biden laid out his foreign policy doctrine on Monday in a sweeping speech just before he leaves office, outlining his support for Ukraine and Israel, his view of the need to counter Chinese competition, and more. Incoming President Donald Trump has vowed to steer the ship in a different direction, and Biden laid out his rationale for staying the course. Anita Powell reports from the White House.
President Joe Biden boiled his 4 years of foreign policy down to this.
Right now, in my view, thanks to our administration, the United States is winning the worldwide competition. Compared to 4 years ago, America is stronger. Our alliances are stronger. Our adversaries and competitors are weaker. We have not gone to war to make these things happen.
Biden leaned heavily on multilateral institutions and norms established after World War II. He cited NATO's enlargement as an example, saying the transatlantic security bloc thwarted Russian President Vladimir Putin's plan to swallow neighboring Ukraine.
When Putin invaded Ukraine, he thought he'd conquer Kyiv in a matter of days. But the truth is, since that war began, I'm the only one that stood in the center of Kyiv, not him. Putin never had.
Biden said authoritarian players like Iran, Russia, China, and North Korea are coming together more out of weakness than out of strength. On the grinding conflict that started in Israel and has enveloped the region, he said his administration was working to put out the fires of a conflict that has raged for more than a year. He touted his work on the largest prisoner swap in modern history last year, And at the White House earlier in the day, his national security advisor pointed to progress on freeing hostages held by Hamas for more than a year. Jake Sullivan is national security advisor.
We think those details are on the brink of being fully hammered out, and the parties are right on the cusp of being able to close this deal. Whether or not we go from where we are now to actually closing it, the hours and days ahead will tell.
Analysts are looking ahead to the presidential handover. Jim Kessler is executive vice president for policy at Third Way.
It's very possible that Joe Biden's foreign policy legacy will be that he is the last president of the United States to support the world order that was created after World War II, because Donald Trump wants to remake it in a very radical way, and he may end up doing so.
Andrew Payne is a lecturer in foreign policy and security at City St. George's, University of London.
This was Biden's attempt to say that diplomacy was back and that he will have a lasting imprint on U.S. foreign policy when the historians look back. I actually think that the way in which historians will remember him is probably going to be defined more by what comes next.
Biden's term ends on January 20th. Anita Powell, viewing news, the White House.
The deadly fires in the Los Angeles area have persisted for a week now, destroying large parts of America's second largest city, even amid firefighters' best efforts to contain the infernos, which have killed at least 25 people as of this writing. Officials say more than 7,000 structures have gone up in flames in the Eaton Fire, which is burning in the Altadena and Pasadena areas north and east of downtown L.A. One of the homes there that was burned to the ground was that of a local firefighter. VOA's Genia DeLu met him and his family.
Isaac Baeze and his family surveyed the ruins of their home, which burned to the ground during the Eaton Fire in the city of Altadena. Baeze, a CAL FIRE firefighter with more than 20 years of experience, says this fire has been unprecedented.
I've never seen, a force of nature like this, the winds and the dryness.
Baez's wife, Rosary, recalls how they received an evacuation notice Tuesday evening, but didn't think much of it. The fire was far away and small. Still, they packed just a few items, not expecting they would return to nothing. In the morning, Baez and his friend came back to try to save the house, but there was no water.
We were just like, oh my God, we can actually like save this. And we went for the hose and there was no water. And so before you knew it, just more things started catching on fire. And I drove away, and I remember looking in my rearview mirror and I could see, the backside of the house going up in flames and just thinking like, man, maybe if I had water, I would have been able to put these, little spot fires out and, prevented my house from burning up.
Fire crews have encountered dry hydrants or low water pressure in efforts to extinguish the Eaton Fire, along with another large wildfire known as the Palisades Fire. California Governor Gavin Newsom announced an investigation into the issue. Currently, fires in Los Angeles, including the Palisades Fire, cover about 150 square kilometers, with more than 150,000 people under evacuation orders. Dry, fast-moving Santa Ana winds spreading the flames are picking up again on Monday, says Los Angeles Fire Chief Kristen Crowley.
A red flag warning is in effect and will remain until 6 p.m. Wednesday evening. Strong Santa Ana winds are also expected to last through Wednesday, with the strongest winds occurring on Tuesday.
Baez's family is staying with friends, waiting for the payout from insurance companies, and have set up a GoFundMe site to raise money for expenses. The Baez's say they're planning to rebuild.
We said we were all going to come back and rebuild and bring back, our neighbors. This is the community. Our kids would play at the end of the cul-de-sac with the other kids. We'd invite each other to birthday parties, and we were very close.
The Los Angeles community overall is coming together in a time of disaster to help displaced families as well as to support firefighters. Emergency shelters and fire stations are overflowing with food and clothes to the point that authorities have had to issue a notice. They now are only accepting monetary donations. Jenya Dulo, VOA News, Los Angeles.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world. On Monday, Lebanese lawmakers put their support behind Nawaf Salam, head of the International Court of Justice, designating him as the country's next prime minister. The move comes as a further blow to Hezbollah, which had in previous years successfully blocked Salam from becoming the head of government. Russian President Vladimir Putin will host his Iranian counterpart this week for the signing of a broad partnership pact between Moscow and Tehran, the Kremlin said on Monday. The agreement on a comprehensive strategic partnership between the countries will be signed during Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian's visit to Moscow on Friday, the Kremlin said. It added the leaders will discuss plans for expanding trade and cooperation in transport, logistics, and humanitarian spheres, along with what they called acute issues on the regional and international agenda. Taiwan's Intelligence Bureau says China's main spy agency is working with criminal gangs, shell companies, and other dubious partners to gain intelligence on Taiwan's defenses, resulting in a major increase in those arrested for alleged espionage on the island. The arrests are in line with China's stepped-up campaign of military intimidation, economic coercion, and gray area tactics, such as utilizing the internet to promote unification and providing all-expense-paid trips to China to low-level government officials. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. We'll take a look at the ongoing civil war in Sudan coming up shortly. First, though, looking at American domestic politics and the upcoming presidential transition. President-elect Donald Trump's pick to lead the Federal Trade Commission has vowed to continue the agency's drive to break up big tech monopolies while adding a focus on free speech. VOA's Matt Tibble reports.
President-elect Donald Trump has chosen Andrew Ferguson to lead the Federal Trade Commission, a federal agency that enforces antitrust and consumer protection laws. Ferguson, a Republican, already serves on the commission, nominated by President Joe Biden to the bipartisan five-member board and confirmed in 2024.
Consumer protection and competition are not partisan issues.
Ferguson previously served as Solicitor General for the state of Virginia and as chief counsel to Senator Mitch McConnell, who spoke at his nomination hearing in 2023.
When Andrew takes on a challenge, he goes all in.
Ferguson has signaled new directions for the independent agency that are more aligned with Trump's priorities. In a document used to promote his candidacy for the top job and obtained by Punchbowl News, Ferguson pledged to fight the bureaucracy to implement President Trump's agenda and lists ways he would redirect the FTC to be more business-friendly while increasing scrutiny of social media companies. Bill Baer is a Brookings Institution visiting fellow and a former director of the FTC's Bureau of Competition.
He's focused a whole lot on tech platforms, both on their economic dominance, but also on their alleged censorship of conservative views.
Trump and other Republicans have frequently targeted content moderation by social media companies. They cite the removal of posts by COVID-19 skeptics and the deplatforming of Trump after the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol as bias against conservative voices. Trump addressed the issue on his campaign website.
That's why today I'm announcing my plan to shatter the left-wing censorship regime and to reclaim the right to free speech for all Americans.
In two cases last year, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in favor of existing content moderation practices by social media companies. Ferguson has suggested that antitrust law could provide another strategy to further Trump's goal.
Whether he can actually use the powers of the Federal Trade Commission to deal with platforms' efforts to make sure bad or inappropriate, grossly inaccurate content is not spread on their platforms is a serious open question. But the platforms have a First Amendment right, just like a newspaper, just like any of us have.
The FTC under current chair Lina Khan already has lawsuits underway against tech giants Meta and Amazon for anti-competitive practices. The threat of increased scrutiny of content moderation policies may be a tipping point for big tech companies to fall in line with Trump's goals. Just last week, Meta announced that it will end fact-checking on Facebook and Instagram and instead move to a system that lets users themselves police the content, much like the community notes on Elon Musk's X. Matt Dibble, VOA News.
Australian authorities are warning of escalating acts of anti-Semitism, which are now being investigated by counter-terrorism officers. A synagogue in Sydney was defaced Saturday with hate symbols, and an attempt was made to start a fire. From Sydney, Phil Mercer has our story.
Red swastikas were daubed along the front fence of a synagogue in Sydney, in the latest act of hate thought to be linked to conflicts in the Middle East. Authorities say the vandalism was an act of violence, hatred and racism. Counter-terrorism police have taken over all the investigations into recent hate attacks on synagogues and other properties in the Australian state of New South Wales. Last Friday, the Alawar Synagogue in Sydney was defaced in a separate incident by anti-Semitic graffiti. In a statement released to local media Sunday, the New South Wales Jewish Board of Deputies, a prominent community organisation, said the Jewish community remained unbowed by attempts of intimidation. In December, a synagogue in Melbourne, Victoria, was firebombed by assailants. Muslim groups have also recorded a surge in Islamophobic abuse since Israel's war in Gaza began in October 2023. Last year, the government in Canberra set up specialist anti-Semitic and Islamophobia community envoys in an attempt to diffuse tensions in the Australian community. Phil Mercer, VOA News, Sydney.
Sudan's army, newly equipped with fresh armaments and recruits, captured the strategic city of Wad Madani from the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces over the weekend. Reuters' David Doyle has more.
In the streets of Wad Madani, civilians and soldiers celebrated what could be a turning point in Sudan's devastating civil war. The strategically important city, capital of Al Jazeera State, was recaptured from the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces by the Sudanese army over the weekend. War broke out in April 2023 over the integration of the Sudan Armed Forces and the RSF. It has created one of the world's largest humanitarian crises. The RSF's occupation of Al Jazeera has turned the fertile state into one at risk of famine. Residents and eyewitnesses say villages were emptied out in violent raids as fields lay fallow or were set on fire. Alam Abdelkader is a lawyer in Wad Madani.
Those people exhausted us in Madani. They looted our belongings and warehouses. They broke into houses, and if they didn't find anything from certain people, they would beat them.
The RSF denies such accusations and says it is fighting rogue actors who are committing abuses. Its leader, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, has admitted defeat in Wad Madani, but insisted that the battle is not over. The army's relatively swift takeover of Wad Madani comes after weeks of advances in surrounding villages. It is newly equipped with armaments and recruits to the Allied forces. The Joint Forces, a collection of former rebel groups, as well as Sudan Shield, led by an RSF defector, participated in the assault. Sources within the RSF say its soldiers were exhausted by airstrikes and dwindling stocks of ammunition and supplies. Eyewitnesses said the RSF withdrew north towards other towns in the state and the capital, Khartoum. If the army is able to regain full control of Al Jazeera State, that could be pivotal in its efforts to choke the RSF supply lines to Khartoum and elsewhere. The RSF still controls most of the capital, though the army has made gains.
And that'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.